This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We touched last week already on the idea that Eliphaz begins to criticize Eov on the speed with which he caves in. Not so much that he caves in under the pressure, but that it's only just started. And at the early stages of the pressure, he's already caving in. And we see that idea expressed also in the Medrash. If you look in your Medrash section, that will be on page 1005. On the top of the left hand column, going on his opening phrases, where Eliphaz says to Eov, Haniso dovor elecho sileh, which we translated in several different ways. You remember the English translated it, Haniso dovor elecho, if one were to direct a word at you, would you be offended? Would it hurt you? But we took a much stronger perush that the Meforshim use, which is Haniso dovor elecho, the thing has just started affecting you. Hashem has just started trying you, and you're already grieved, you're already angry. And if one looks at it more accurately, this haniso is a question: has Hashem yet tried you that you are angry, that you have become grieved? Now, of course, the answer is yes. Of course, he's been tried already. He's already had some terrible suffering. What does Eliphaz mean when he says, "Has Hashem tried you that you've already become angry?" And on that, the Medrash says here, Amalei Eliphaz le'Iov. Eliphaz said to Eov, Ato mashve oischo la'Avrohom. You compare yourself to Avraham. Much further on in the Sefer, Shneemar, as it says, Vos mashel ke'ofer va'ifer. Eov uses a phrase that Avraham coined, that is, that and I am like nothing but dust and ashes, implying that he puts himself on the level of Avraham in a certain way. Now you remember in the early stages of the Sefer, we already established that one of the functions of the Sotan, and you remember that the Sotan was the inherent degeneration that takes place, which was in turn responsible for the fact that generations have deteriorated too, that we're not on the same stature as people were, or as Avraham was in that period. And we said one of the reasons for that was to ensure that nobody reached the level of Avraham. That's part of the Sotan's job, is to be able to show the Ribbono Shel Olam that nobody has yet reached up to the level of Avraham. So the fact that Eov compares himself to Avraham is already dangerous. And Eliphaz brings in that and says, you're comparing yourself to Avraham. V'hu danosi kedor haflogo. And then you're going on to say, in my actions I am compared to Avraham, yet Hashem is judging me, He's treating me like the Dor HaPlogo, He's treating me like the people of the Tower of Babel. That's the claim that Eov places, as I say, much later on, at the end of the Sefer, Shneemar Horeini Lechema. It says Eliphaz, one line further down, V'chi ma'asecho ke'Avraham. On what basis do you have the right to compare yourself to Avraham? Is your reaction, is your response, are your deeds in any way comparable to those of Avraham? Haniso dover elecho tlo, Avraham nisnoso ba'asoro nisyonis ba'omad bukulon. Avraham was tried 10 times and he saw through them all, he went through them all. Ve'ato b'nisoyin echod, and you're collapsing after one trial. Hashem's just started with you and you're already collapsing. So again we see this idea that we did last week, that the fact that he hasn't lost it, the fact that he hasn't been able to sustain it at all, the fact that he hasn't been able to weather the storm, is what Eliphaz is focusing on. If a person is gone and he's suffered over and over again, and it's been a long time of suffering, then Eliphaz is not going on that. That's a different, perhaps then the person becomes more understandable for the person to start having claims against the Ribbono Shel Olam. But you, Eov, it's true, it's been a hard knock, but it's only been it's very recent, it's only just happened, it's only a few days. After a few days of suffering, is it fair, is it right, do you have a basis to already be knocking the Ribbono Shel Olam? Which means that suffering needs to be seen also in terms of its continuation. one can tolerate suffering more easily in short dosages. And Viktor Frankl makes the point, it helps a great deal if you know when the end of the dose is going to be. If you've got something to work on, something to handle, you know, no matter how bad it's going to be. He says the main suffering in the concentration camps was that people didn't know how long it was going to last. Looking back, we look back and we say it was 5 years. It wasn't even 5 years. Most people didn't get into the concentration camps right in the beginning, and some got out before the end. So we look back and we think 5 years, and we try and evaluate to ourselves how terrible could 5 years have been. 5 years isn't all that terrible if at the beginning you know it's only 5 years, and you know you're going to come out okay at the end of it. Then you can tolerate 5 years of suffering. But at that time they didn't know if it was going to be 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or there forever. And the feeling was not only inside the concentration camps, but the feeling was in the world altogether, in the Jewish world, that this caused tremendous pessimism. There was a feeling among those whose belief was not strong that this was the end of the Jewish people. What was going to happen? What was going to be? The yeshivas were all destroyed. The printing presses were all destroyed. The libraries were all destroyed. The Gedolei Yisrael, the great leaders and the great Torahites of the Jewish people were all destroyed. There was a feeling of total pessimism. And that's the element of suffering that is most difficult to handle. That absolute pessimism, the belief that it's the end, the belief that it's bad and it's going to get worse, that's what really wears people down. That's what people find very, very difficult to live with and to cope with. That's why the thing that people say jokingly is not a joke at all, when people say this is going to be an average year, it's worse than last year but not as good as next year, but not as bad as next year. That kind of feeling that we're on the slopes, we're on the way down, that's very pessimistic, that's very negative, that's very hard to live with. And that's what Eliphaz is going on at Eov. It's only just happened. Who says it's going to carry on this way? There's a chance to wait, give it a chance to come right. Don't get so negative from the very beginning. Don't give up hope to that degree. And that element of whether one views that one's difficulties as long term or not is not dependent on the difficulties. That's dependent on the perception of the individual. And again, that's what Eliphaz is hitting Eov with. That's why he's blaming him for it. He's not saying that the suffering wasn't bad. Of course the suffering was bad. What we're blaming you for is cracking under it, in other words, seeing it as the end of the world. It isn't yet the end of the world. You've still got a life in front of you. And to see that suffering as the end of the world is something for which you are responsible, Eve. You have no right to see it that way. No matter how severe it is, no matter how difficult it is, you have no right to see it that way. And we discussed last week how people rebuilt themselves, how people came out of terrible destruction with everything lost and re-established themselves, whether in Israel or in the United States, and from nothing at all started rebuilding, reconstructing their lives. If one is willing to look at one's life at a future, then one's relationship to the suffering is totally different. The perception of what happens is really what determines it all. Today I was counseling a person who came through quite a crisis. What's the crisis? He's got no real tzoras. It's a lot of nonsense, his crisis. He thinks he's getting old. And there are various reasons why he thinks he's getting old, and it's put him into a certain crisis. He's actually the editor of a newspaper, quite an important newspaper. And surveys were done showing that his newspaper appeals only to old fogies. And when he analysed the results of the survey, he questioned what is an old fogey, what are they defined as an old fogey, and they found that he fitted into the definition. And that caused him to go into quite some crisis, that he was producing a product for old fogies, and he'd become an old fogey himself, and he wasn't able to think young anymore, and that's the end of his life. And it actually got him into a point where he really was not able to think young, and he was not able to be creative, and he got himself into a downward cycle, and his whole newspaper was on the way down. The newspaper was bright enough to realize that he's a good person and they mustn't lose him. And I said to him, you know, you can look at it two ways. You're right, you're getting older. That's number one. There are no two ways about that. There's only one way about that. You are an old fogey. But there are two ways of looking at it. You have a choice. You can either hang on to your youth and be an old young person, Maybe a real aging, frayed young person. You know, you see these people who cling on to their youth, and they try and dress like young people, and they try and act like young people, and they look ridiculous. And they're clinging on, they're trying on to sort of still look like hippies a little bit. And it just doesn't fit them. So I said, that's your one chance, is you can belong to the young set, but you're really on the old side of the young set. You're old, you're finished, you've got no fresh ideas. Or you can let yourself shift into the next phase. You can let yourself shift into the phase of an older person, and you can be a young older person, a bright young older person. You can be the trendsetter among the older people. What do you have to hang on to be a real old leftover of the young people? And I saw by the sparkle in his eye that it appealed to him. Things happen to us that by the way we determine how we look at it, we determine whether we allow it to be a cause of suffering or not. And that's what Eliphaz is hitting at Yevet. Yes, something has happened, but you've turned it into the end of your life. It's not the end of your life. It's an event in your life. It's not the end of your life, and you aren't to see it as the end of your life. Now let's get back into chapter 4 and read through, because in chapter 4, Eliphaz is going to suggest the first answer to Eve's question. He has rejected Eve's answer. You remember the question is, we know that Eve is a tzaddik, we know that God is just, and we know that God is omnipotent, but can't all three be right? Because if they're all right, why is poor Eve suffering? And so Eve comes to the conclusion he's not willing to compromise on God's justice, and he's not willing to compromise on the fact that he knows that he's a tzaddik. That's one of the axioms on which the book is built. But he's left to compromise only on one issue, the thing that he feels compromises God's dignity least of all, and that is to assume that God designed the world in such a way that there are powers and forces that affect human beings quite outside of the Ribbono Shel'olam's own control. And therefore it can happen by coincidence that a person has tragedies, although he doesn't deserve them. That leaves him feeling comfortable. I don't deserve what's happened. That's a nice comforting feeling. It leaves his faith intact. God is still just, and I still believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. But it introduces an additional element into the world. The element of a self-programmed sense of nature that can affect people outside of God's will. But that he would rather live with that than to live with anything else that might shake up his belief. And Eliphaz has challenged that and said that's out of the question. And let's start at the beginning of chapter 4 again and read through the chapter. And Eliphaz the Temani answered and he said, which we've now translated as, have you even started to be tried and you're already complaining? Who can withhold themselves from speaking against you? You make us so angry. This is so unjustified, and we discussed last week what an interesting technique of counseling this is. Not sympathizing with him, not saying, poor Eve, yes, you're right, Eve, what a terrible time you're having, but coming onto the attack and making Eve have to defend himself. To put Eve in the defensive is what Eliphaz does. Hinei yisarta rabim, you've given musar, you've chastised many people. V'yodayim rofo is techazek, and now he says with sarcasm. And you have strengthened many weak hands. Koshel yekimun milecho. People who've been stumbling in their belief have been re-established by you. You've uplifted them. Uvirkayim koiris to ametz, and you've given strength to collapsing knees. Ki ato tovo yelecho vatele. For this has just begun to happen to you, and you're already complaining. Tiga odecho vatibohel. It has just begun to touch you, Batibo Hill, and you've gone into Beholo, you've gone into panic. And that Batibo Hill is perhaps one of the most important accusations against Eve. Batibo Hill, you've gone into panic, you've gone into an irrational state, and you're saying things that are not correct. That there's no justification for. Yes, you're suffering, but there's no justification for Beholo. Haloi yirosecho kislosecho. And now he begins to attack Eve's belief, Eve's faith. Your fear, yirosecho, your fear of God has been because of your own hopes. Tikvotzecho v'soyim derochecho. Your hopes and the purity of your ways. In other words, your fear of God has not been genuine, but it has been your fear of loss and your desire for reward. That's what it is. And the proof of that is that the moment the loss had occurred and you have nothing more to lose, the moment reward was removed from you, you showed no further need to show that Yiro, to show that God-fearing, to show that spirituality and that faith that you used to have before. What does that indicate? What does that show? That shows, in fact, exactly as the Satan had accused him, that it isn't genuine. And that's why you've strengthened so many people. Everybody was asking the question. Everybody thought you were a tzaddik, Iyuv. Everybody thought you were righteous. They always all thought you were the most righteous person in the world. You had all the symptoms of a righteous person. And therefore, when you began to suffer, everybody was asking why. And people were losing their faith over this, Iyuv. Until you started questioning God, then people heaved a sigh of relief and they were able to say, "Ah, we thought Eve was righteous, he obviously wasn't." We can see now by the way he's handling the pressure that that wasn't righteousness, that was just the fear of loss, that was just the desire for reward. So that the true test can only take place when the pressure is on. When things are going okay, there's no test of religiousness. We don't know whether we're religious or not. There's no way we can know whether we're religious or not. There's no way we can know whether we're fine or not, whether we're noble or not, until the pressure is on. When we have to make choices under pressure, that's the only time that we can really know what's what and where we stand. And then he says to him, Mihu noki ovod, ve'efo yoshorim nichechodu. Eve, can you tell me a clean person, a pure person, Ovod, who was wiped out? Where are the Yeshurim? Where are the straight people? Nichechodu, who have been destroyed. And so he challenges Eve's proposition. Eve says, it can happen. You can have a righteous person who's wiped out. That's a very comfortable belief. It's not a very moral belief in a sense, but it's a comfortable belief because then there are no questions. Why is so-and-so suffering? He's such a tzaddik. The answer is these things happen. Why is so-and-so having it so good? He's such a wicked person. Because there is a system of nature and things happen even if it's not exactly how God would want it. These things happen. Comfortable to believe that, then you don't have any major crises of faith. But says Eliphaz, I've never seen anybody who's really a tzaddik, who's really pure and who's been wiped out. And here Eliphaz starts the very important process of discernment, of differentiating between suffering and suffering. Now the way we normally differentiate between suffering and suffering is how bad the suffering is. Heavy suffering and not so heavy suffering. Eliphaz says that's not the critical differentiation. If you're going to try and differentiate and classify different forms of suffering, the important classification is whether he's ovad or not, whether the person has been totally destroyed or he hasn't. If a person has been totally destroyed, then even if he didn't suffer that much, that's a terrible thing. One of the worst punishments that we have in the Torah is what we call kores, which is just destruction, spiritual destruction. It's not necessarily painful, but it's the worst thing that there is. We don't necessarily seek a painless life. And painlessness is not necessarily bliss, and it's not necessarily progress, and it's not necessarily achievement. Painlessness is comfort, but right in the beginning of the Sefer we discussed the difference between comfort and happiness, the difference between comfort and joy, the difference between comfort and achievement. We don't necessarily seek painlessness, and so you can't classify suffering in terms of how painful it is. What you can classify it is in terms of its consequences, of its end result. Suffering that results in destruction is the worst on the scale of suffering. Suffering that results in repair is the best in the scale of suffering, irrespective of how much suffering it is. That's what one has to look at. So you can look at a person who goes through Rachmana Litzlan, terrible chemotherapy and suffers terribly while he's being while he's receiving that therapy. Terrible, terrible suffering. And yet he knows that the end result will be okay, and that keeps him going. And when he gets there, when he gets to the other side, it's fine, it's okay. And sometimes you'll find the suffering where a person might be afflicted with a fatal disease that isn't so painful, but he's going to die at the end of it, and it's not going to be all that long, and he knows that he isn't suffering the pain. Who suffers worse? Which is the worst suffering? We must be careful not to measure suffering in terms of the pain it inflicts, but rather in terms of the result it brings about. Suffering that brings about positive results is positive suffering. Suffering that brings about negative results is negative suffering. Not the pain is not the ikkar. The main thing is the result. And who determines the result of the suffering? We can do that ourselves. That we can master. We can't control the suffering. And we can't always control the pain of the suffering. There's a limit to the extent of pain management. It's becoming a whole new field in medicine, the importance of pain management. That if you can't do anything, at least make the person comfortable. Yes, sure, that's important. And people can do a certain amount themselves also to relieve their pain. But more important is suffering management. And suffering management is to ensure that there's a sense of meaning and a sense of purpose. That at the end of it, the result is going to be positive, not negative. Because if the result of is positive, we don't call it suffering. If you watch people training for the comrades, and never mind if you actually watch the comrades itself, but you just watch in the mornings when you see these people running, look on their faces and see the suffering. Absolute, terrible, terrible suffering. Their faces, you can see they're in agony. And I always joke, you know, I look behind them to see who's chasing them. Why are they running? It's difficult for me to conceive of the fact that they could be running even if they weren't suffering so much. To me, any running is suffering. So to just the fact that they're running is already a little bit difficult to understand. But that they're running with such distorted faces, they're suffering such pain. Who's chasing them? What's happening? Nobody's chasing. They're self-motivated. Self-motivated by what? By the fact that to them the suffering is worthwhile. There's something at the end of it. They're going to take a shower when they finish, and they're going to feel wonderful. Look how much suffering people are prepared to go through in order to feel wonderful afterwards. And is that suffering or isn't it suffering? It's not suffering. For them it's not suffering. For me it would be suffering. So who determines whether it is or whether it isn't? That we can manage ourselves. We can control that ourselves. Running still maybe is not such a kasha. They don't pay for it. But you go to these gyms, and there they pay. They charge them a lot of money to come in. And you see them lifting these things, and then you see the agony on the face and the pain on the face. It's a pleasure to just stand and watch there, because you can learn so much. Just watch these people suffering and say, why are they doing it? And you can ask them afterwards. You say to the person, it's worthwhile doing it sometimes. Wait till he's finished and watch his face, and you hear his krechts, and you think, you've had nothing on this guy. And you see it up again, and he gets the weights up and down. And you think, well, that's the last time. He's not going to manage another time. And then you see him getting ready for one more time. And up he goes again. And this face and the distortion and all these muscles standing out. And the perspiration pouring down. And down he comes. And again he does it. And again and again. It's worthwhile standing there until he's finished. And when he's finished, just saying, why did you do that to yourself? Why did you do it? And I suppose you're going to come again tomorrow? He says, sure, every day I'm here. Every single day of your life. Why do you do it? What's the answer? I feel good afterwards. I'm willing to do it because I feel good afterwards. We're willing to do anything if we know that we'll feel good afterwards. It's like that when you learn a piece of Gemara also. When you start off with a piece of Gemara, it's not easy. There's no pleasure in it at all. And anybody who says that there is has never learned a piece of Gemara properly. When you start off, there's no pleasure whatever. It's after several hours of working on it that the pleasure begins. So why are we prepared to do it? Because we feel good afterwards. That's why we do it. So many worthwhile things we do involve such suffering in the process, such self-inflicted suffering in the process. So what right have we got to get angry with God when He occasionally gives us suffering if we do it to ourselves all the time? And the way we work, watch people working. Getting up early, and they run, and they rush, and they put themselves under pressure. What are they doing it for? They could live with less. So instead of two cars, they'll have one car. Instead of a big house, they'll have a small house. But they won't have to work so hard. But they want to. It feels good. They want the sense of achievement. People are willing to do it. They're willing to risk their lives. They're willing to risk their health. They're willing to risk anything and everything in order to feel good afterwards. And that's a very valid feeling. That's what life is all about. That's the whole purpose of coming to this world. Why didn't God just leave us up there? We were happy souls before He brought us down here. And the Gemara goes into a whole discussion, were people better off being born or not being born? And the conclusion is we were better off not being born. The fact is, so why do we go through all this effort? Because we'll feel wonderful afterwards. That's what it is. We'll feel wonderful afterwards, having achieved it all ourselves, having been able to look back and say, look what we did, look what we achieved, look at the path we've travelled. So Hashem also puts us through that in the knowledge that we would choose ourselves to do that, to go through any amount of suffering if the end result is good. And that's what Eliphaz tells Eiv. Mihu noki avod. Eiv, can you name me one person who's suffering, one clean person, one pure person, whose suffering destroyed him? That's what we need to find out. Not whether he suffered or not. Shredder people who suffer. We inflict suffering upon ourselves, we grow through suffering. What you've got to look at is there anybody who's been destroyed by suffering? That's all that's important. I gave the example once of the you go to these fun fairs that they have. The Rand show is coming up, they usually have one of these things. Also interesting to watch the people there. And you watch these really violent games, rides that they put people on. You know, these things that go upside down and swing all over the place. And you see queues of youngsters standing up to go on these things, lines of them. And they're expensive. And when they get on again, you watch their faces, distorted suffering. Their faces are totally distorted in suffering. They scream, they yell. They believe that there's a moment in that game where they're sure they're going to die. They don't think they might die. They know they're going to die. They know they're not going to come out of this thing alive. And then finally it's over and they finish. They come, they stand at the queue again. They want to go a second time. What is it? What's important to them is that they've seen other people come off alive. They know people don't get killed on it. That's what keeps them going. And that's what Eliphaz says. Suffering is okay if you know you can survive it. And who can you name me one Nochi Ovod? Can you tell me a clean person, a pure person who was destroyed by his suffering? Therefore you show him Nichachodu, and where are the straight people who have been so destroyed? And here he talks in the plural, not in the singular. Inasmuch as I have seen evildoers who have been cut down by suffering, there I've seen destruction. Who are the people who self-destruct? Who are the people who destroy themselves through their life cycles, through the things that they do? Those are the wicked people who destroy themselves. Don't look at the process. Don't look at the amount of suffering in the process. Look at the result of it. And see where you have destruction and where you don't have destruction. It's a wonderful insight into suffering. Minishma teloika yovedu, they get blown away by a breath of Hashem. Umiruach apo yichlu, and they get destroyed by the breath of his nostrils. Shagas arye vekol shochal. The roar of the lion and the sound of the mighty lion, v'shinei kefirim nitol, and the teeth of the young lions can be broken. He gives an interesting image here. Layish oyved mibli toref uvnei lovi yisparodu. Yet the old lion can perish for lack of prey, and the lion's cubs are scattered all over. And now this piece of Tanakh, you can only know if you've spent a little bit of time, and you can only understand if you spent a little bit of time in a game reserve. The lion is the most powerful of the animals, and you see him in his prime. You see that power. You see how all the other animals titter when he's around. You see how his own cubs titter when he's around. You see this mighty animal. You look at his paws, and you see the force in his legs and his paws and his claws. And if you're able to watch a kill, and you see how he does that, and how she does that, and how they operate, and yet the old lions die of hunger. So pathetic. And the little lions also die of hunger sometimes. All that power, all that strength, and at the end it doesn't help him one little bit. And that's the image he gives. You're looking at certain Rishoyim, you're looking at certain wicked people, and you're saying, look at them in their primes, look how powerful they are, look how everything goes their way. But you're not looking at the whole scale, you're not looking at the whole panorama. You're isolating them in a period of their existence, and you're saying, look at their power. But if you look at it all the way through, you realize that power crumbles eventually. It doesn't. It's not seen through. Not so with the tzaddik. The tzaddik you don't see. No, he doesn't look like a lion necessarily. But nor does he die of starvation. Ve'elai dover yugunov. And I'll tell you, Iyov, says Eliphaz, I'm able to get a glimpse of something. Batikach ozni shemetz minehu. And my ear has been able to absorb just a little tiny bit of this particular idea which I'm going to share with you. Bishi'ifim mechezyonos loylo. Binafol tardemo al anoshim. I had a vision, a prophetic vision. It came upon me when people sleep at night. Pachad kira'ani uro'odo. I found myself in fear and trembling. V'ro'yivatz v'isai hifchid. And most of my bones began to shake. V'ruach al-ponai yachaloif. And the spirit came passing over my face. T'samer sa'aras besorai. It made the hair on my flesh stand up. Yamoid v'lo yakir mar'ehu. It seemed to stand still, this vision, but I couldn't see it clearly. Tumuno l'neged eino, it was an image opposite my eyes. Demomo, it was silent, yet v'kol eshmo, yet I heard a sound. And this is the prophecy that I was told, this is the message that I understood from it. And he's already, in the way he describes this prophecy, he already shows the inadequacy of the human being to fully understand what he's being told by God. That even in my prophetic state, says Eliphaz, I couldn't understand it all. It was an image. I glimpsed something of it. I was able to absorb just a little bit of it. And that's how life is sometimes too. God talks to us in life and we can catch glimpses of it, but we don't necessarily have the capacity to understand it all. What was it that I was able to understand? Ha'enosh me'elokai yitzdok. Is it possible for man to be righteous before God? Im me'osehu yithar gover. Can a person even be clear, ever be clear from his Creator? Meaning that on the one hand the Ribbono Shel Olam is enormous in what he is, in his essence, and there's no way that we can appreciate him fully, and therefore that we can function 100% in accordance with his will, because his will is just too big for us. So if we're looking at absolutes, Eliphaz is saying, there is no such thing as a tzaddik. We cannot be totally righteous vis-a-vis our perception of the Ribbono Shel Olam, of God. He's just too big, he's just too mighty, he's just beyond our, too much beyond our comprehension. And on the other hand, not only in terms of his essence, but even the fact that Oseihu, that he created us and he has given us life, we can never clear ourselves of indebtedness. So in terms of philosophic understanding, he's beyond us. In terms of our capacity to fulfill his will, it's beyond us. In terms of our ability to repay our indebtedness to him, that's beyond us too. So there doesn't exist in Jewish life the concept of a perfect man. It doesn't exist. It's something we strive towards, it's something we approach, but it's not anything we can ever actually reach. The idea of human perfection is not a Jewish idea. In Christianity you've got human perfection, and they created a particular person who never sinned, never did anything wrong, was absolutely perfect. It's just not real, it's artificial. And the reason that it's artificial is because it is beyond the human being to be able to comprehend what's expected of him. It's built into nature. It makes it impossible for the human being to be perfect, which is important to know for several reasons. Number one, it's comforting. So that's no excuse for being imperfect, but at least it allows one to know that Hashem has to tolerate imperfections, because it's built into the creation. It's inevitable that there's going to be imperfection. And the second thing that's important is that we know that there's no way we can ever finish the job. We're actually approaching a point on the horizon, but we never actually get there. As we move forward, there's a new horizon before us. It's an infinite job, and we can only move. It's a sense of movement, it's not a sense of actually arriving ever. Hein ba'avodov lo yamin. Even in Hashem's own servants he cannot trust. Uvimlochov yosin toholo. Nor in his angels can he place total praise. Af sheikh ne botei chumer. Asher be'afar yisoidom yedakum lifnei osh. Even those, or the English translates it quite accurately, how much more so those who dwell in houses of clay whose foundations are in the dust. Miboike lo erev yukosu, mibli meisim lo netzach yovedu. Between morning and evening they can be destroyed. They perish forever without anybody paying heed. Haloinisa yisrom bom yomusu velo bechochma. Is not their excellency which was in them gone away? They die, for they are with wisdom. What is he saying in this last part? There is no way that we can match up to the full expectations that Ribbono Shel Olam has of us. And therefore there is no way we can escape suffering altogether. Not only suffering is in the sense of punishment, but suffering in the sense of learning, suffering in the sense of refinement, and suffering in the sense of avoiding ultimate destruction. And Liphaz introduces here the concept of suffering as a refining process, and that part of the function of this world is to suffer in a material way to avoid having to suffer in a spiritual way. So that in physical suffering there is in fact an element of mercy as far as God is concerned. But in order to protect us from destruction, in order to protect us from really long term suffering, we have to go through the short term. Now there are many examples of this, because life manifests this concept in many different ways, and one is the example that we just used a little bit earlier, that in order to stay fit you need to exercise. Exercising is suffering, but that's the way it is. There isn't any achievement that can be reached, any long term meaningful achievement that can be reached without the exertion of effort, which is a form of suffering. And so Eliphaz says to Eve, the suffering is like miboiker ad orev. We go to work in the morning and we suffer, we work hard, but we come back in the evening and we can relax, we can enjoy the fruits of our labors. That's how one has to see any kind of suffering that Hashem brings to his tzaddikim, that Hashem brings to his righteous people. Again, two kinds of suffering. The one we're not talking about, the suffering that results in destruction, that we're not talking about. But since it's impossible for us to fulfill God's expectations totally, we must realize that part of our life is going to involve suffering. But we must view that suffering as a temporary phase, as we would view the suffering that we go through in a day in order to reach the night. And we know that, and we understand that, and we accept that. So we need to understand that in order to reach the perfection at the end of our lives that Hashem wants us to reach, it's necessary for us to go through this process of suffering. And so says Eliphaz, I don't accept that there's any compromise of God's justice. I don't accept that there's any compromise of God's omnipotence. But I don't accept either that you are an absolute tzaddik. And the proof that you're not a tzaddik is that you're collapsing after a small amount of suffering. Why are you doing that? Because your perceptions are wrong. Why are your perceptions wrong? Because you're not approaching life correctly, you're not approaching God correctly, you're not approaching yourself correctly. In that case, you're in fact not a tzaddik. If you're not a tzaddik, the suffering that you're getting is righteous. It's not some outside force. That is God Himself. And He's bringing that suffering upon you in order to make sure that you're able to achieve what He needs you to achieve without resulting in any kind of spiritual suffering. The only suffering He's brought upon you has been physical. You've lost your family, you've lost your part of your wealth, you've lost your social position, you've lost your health, but you haven't lost your neshama. You haven't lost your righteousness and your potential for righteousness. The essential things are still in place, and that Hashem won't touch. That's the suffering of a tzaddik, as opposed to the suffering of a rosha. Now, of course, this is only the first stage in a very long argument. Eve's not going to accept this argument too easily, nor necessarily are Eliphaz's other friends, and the argument will be developed as we go through. On the surface, we would tend to say that Eliphaz is coming out strong, but I think Eliphaz has managed to convince us at this point. We started off entirely sympathizing with Eve. Eliphaz has exposed a chink in Eve's armor and shown us that Eve isn't quite the perfect man he and we thought he was. And so our sympathies have shifted a little bit, and we're beginning to say to ourselves, Eve, I think you've been overestimating yourself. And if you would take a proper look at yourself, you would realize that you're not quite as righteous as you think. And yet Chazal already at this stage come out quite strongly against Eliphaz and say about him, the Torah says, Loi soinu ish es amisoi. You're not allowed to oppress your friend. And the Gemara asks, is that, you've got this in your Medrash, back on that same 1005. It's in the middle of that left hand column on 1005. It says, Tanu Rabbonin, if you've got that, just a little bit above the middle of the page. What kind of oppression are we talking about? Is it talking about verbal oppression or material oppression? There's already a different area where material oppression is discussed. So this oppression, when the Torah says thou shalt not oppress your friend, it's talking about verbal oppression.